I'm speaking with Paul Lawton. He's been a guest here before on WATD. He's a naval historian, a deep water diver, and a lawyer. And the way that I know you is through a number of things that you've been involved in, including the sinking of the USS Eagle, PE-56. I believe you were the only person, I think, in U.S. history that actually got the Navy to change the scenario or the official outcome of what happened, and tell our listeners what that was. Wasn't that a U.S. warship hit by a submarine off the coast of New England that they first denied and said it was a boiler explosion, but that's not what it was at all?
Right. Thanks, Christine. Yeah, the Eagle 56 was a case I was involved with going back about 20 years ago. It was the last American warship sunk in American coastal waters during World War II. It was sunk on April 23, 1945, off the coast of Portland, Maine, with a loss of 49 of its 62 crewmen. It was a Navy subchaser, and it was torpedoed by a German U-boat, the U-853, which was sunk 12 days later on May 6, 1945, off the coast of Block Island, Rhode Island, with a loss of her entire 55-man crew. And for 56 years, the Navy had basically blamed the crew for blowing up their own ship, claiming they were negligent and caused their ship to explode as a result of a boiler explosion. And I fought the Navy for approximately 5 years and found witnesses and forensic evidence and naval documentation that actually proved that they knew the entire time that the submarine, the U-853, had torpedoed their ship, killing those men, and they were denied Purple Hearts during that period of time.
You know, it's interesting. We were talking a little bit off air, and we were getting some numbers to put things into perspective. I know you've done a lot of deep water diving. You've done a lot of diving on wrecks. Typically, if people are just doing regular scuba diving, what's the limit? Is it about 100 feet that they go down?
Yeah, under a lot of the training or numbers you'll see is roughly 130 feet. The most, you know, most people probably wouldn't exceed 90 feet, but if you're diving with a single tank, straight air, you're talking basically about 130 feet.
Okay.
Before you need special training, you should have backup tanks, redundant tanks, bailout bottles or twin tanks, and different types of gas mixtures because, you know, regular atmospheric air is kind of toxic at those depths.
Okay. And I'm leading up to this because I want to ask you some questions from your perspective about this horrible incident that happened with the submersible. All people on board, it looks like they were killed instantly after a very, very detailed search to find them. There's a couple things that I don't understand about it, and excuse me if I sound very pedestrian because I don't know that much about diving. Mm-hmm. First of all, why was the U.S. Coast Guard involved if this incident happened 900 miles off the coast of Cape Cod? In international waters.
Yeah, you know, they probably, it's a jurisdictional thing with the Navy. The strange thing is the Coast Guard doesn't have any facilities to handle something like this. They don't have deep submergence capabilities. They don't really, they have ROVs, remote operated vehicles that they use in ports to check the hulls of ships and so forth for contraband, but they have no real long distance capability. They have ships that can make it out there 900 miles offshore, but really it's the Navy really are the only people that have any capability. They have DSRVs, deep submergence recovery vehicles, but those are really only designed to recover men from stricken American fleet submarines. And our fleet submarines generally aren't rated to dive more than about 1,300 feet. I mean, the real dive depths are classified. The deepest diving military submarine in the world is a Russian titanium-hulled submarine called the Alpha Class, which is a nuclear-powered submarine, and it has a very strong hull. That's capable of 3,000 feet, which is incredible depths and incredible pressure. But our DSRVs are generally deployed on a couple of ships like the USS Grasp and the USS Grapple, which are submarine recovery ships. Those are generally around the East Coast. Those were the vessels that were involved in the Kennedy recovery of young JFK a number of years ago when he crashed off of Martha's Vineyard. But those have a limited diving depth. They're not rated for 12,000. I don't believe they could come anywhere near 12,000 feet. So they have some exploratory submarines like the Alvin that sometimes is in Woods Hole that are capable of those depths. The Russians really have, they have several submarines. One of them is called the Mir, and that's very a well-known submarine, a deep-diving submersible. It's very robust. The Russians are known for making things very robust.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, if you can explain this part to me, I know that the submersible with the Ocean Expedition was launched off of, or if that's the correct word, off of, was it the Polar Prince or the Polar Princess? If they launched it off that boat, which was the mothership, and lost contact within, I think, an hour and 45 minutes, if they had the general area where they launched it, why was the search field twice the size of the state of Connecticut? Wouldn't it have been easier to have a much smaller field to search? That's what I don't understand.
Yeah, I think what happened is they may have speculated that they had a problem, an issue, an emergency, and then dropped ballast and came to the surface, which was what they were designed to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a problem, get back to the surface. So they you would normally have, and I saw the designs of the submarine, it seemed that the skids had lead weights that they could be released internally. A lot of these other submarines have shot ballast, which is basically lead pellets that are released. And so you can just drop ballast and lighten the vessel, and it will slowly start to come back to the surface. I believe they thought that maybe they come to the surface, which would have taken hours. And during that period of time, there were deep sea currents. And then if they popped to the surface and aren't seen, they could have been miles away from the ship and then traveling in that current. I think that's why, because they were using P-3 Orions that the Canadians still use, their former American sub-search aircraft, which use what's called MAD, which is magnetic anomaly detection,
mm-hmm.
which is a metal detector. And that picks up the signature of a ferrous metal object like a submarine. That's what they're used for, is to track submarines. And the thing is, it would not detect anything like the Titanic wreck under 12,000 feet. That's just too far. So they were using that to pick up the magnetic signature of any type of metal structure on mm-hmm. the submarine itself, which could have been the titanium end caps or a lot of other components that were built onto that submarine.
Now, typically, what was the pressure inside the Titan? Do you know, like, what is typical? What is the pressure inside?
They were,
and then
talking,
I'm going to go to outside.
Yeah, it's about a half a pound per foot. So you're talking 12,000 feet. I think the calculation, 6,000 pounds per mm-hmm. inch. So you look at the entire structure, that the pressure vessel itself is carbon fiber, 5 inches thick, 22 feet long, probably 8 to 10 feet in diameter. And then mm-hmm. you get the titanium end caps. Figure out how many square inches there are on that, and then multiply that by 6,000 pounds per inch, and you're talking, I saw a guy on TV who appeared to be an engineer. He apparently did the calculation, and he was talking in the millions of tons of pressure on that entire pressure vessel, which is absolutely astronomical. I thought about it, and then I started to work on a calculation. I said, I think this guy's right.
With they believe they died from an implosion, was it immediate?
Did
they know
what
was coming, or just happened?
When you have under that pressure, there isn't a leak, there isn't a drip of water. As soon as you have a structural failure like that, the implosion is violent, it's instantaneous, it happened within a fraction, probably a hundredth or thousandth of a second, and it's total and complete. The devastation would have been absolute. They would not have known what happened. They simply would have been atomized within a fraction of a second.
So many people, and myself included, so upset thinking about these poor people waiting to be helped at the bottom.
That was my, and that really, I was sick to my stomach, because I showed you these bathyspheres that some friends of mine I was working with on some dives, particularly for the Eagle 56. They have a salvage vessel out of the Miramar Yacht Basin up in the Merrimack River. Captains Wally and Jay Lazinski, and Wally was the father, who was a former Coast Guardsman. He's since passed away. He got his hands on one of these ancient bathyspheres, when I say ancient, 1930s,
mm-hmm.
which were circular steel balls, that a circular object is probably the strongest to withstand those pressures. And these guys would basically, these were attached to the ship by a cable, and they had a comms unit where they could communicate mm-hmm. with the telephone, and they'd have electric powerful lights and so forth. They generally didn't have a feed of oxygen. They'd have oxygen tanks attached to this. But these set records in 1934 for 3,000 feet, which was absolutely, and they were doing these off the Bahamas. And they were seeing fish that they had never seen before, and reporting on that for the New York Zoological Society and National Geographic. Somehow, Warren Lazinski got him his hands on one of these bathyspheres, and in here I could show you they were actually building this to be a submersible that was not tethered. So they had thrusters attached. They were building an aft unit with syntactic non-compressible foam that the batteries and compressed air tanks and all the other equipment to make this an individual submarine. And I was up there, I saw it, and climbed into it. And, you know, I don't think I'm claustrophobic because I've been inside of shipwrecks in very closed environments, deep underwater in pitch black. And I sat inside this thing and thought of somebody bolting the door closed. And I had to get out of there. I was actually shaken. I couldn't do it. I absolutely couldn't do it.
I agree with you about the bolting
the door
shut.
So I've been studying submarines my entire life. I've got two books. I've done a half dozen documentaries on shipwrecks and underwater searches for submarine wrecks. And in 2005, I was actually involved in an expedition to find a sunken submarine, an American submarine called the O-9, which sank in 1941 off the Isles of Shoals, New Hampshire. And that's a grave site. There were 33 men still entombed on board that. And I've got photographs of our expedition up there. That's actually in one of the control rooms where the guys are down there actually monitoring. We used ROVs from, I think it was at that, we did two trips out there. One of them was a University of Connecticut ship, and one was a University of New Hampshire. So they're very, very big ships that had a lot of equipment, the ability to launch ROVs and so forth.
Now, speaking of ROVs, reportedly the company who made the ROV that found the debris was from Cape Cod, the company that did the manufacturing
of
it.
There was a company that I did business with because I was buying fittings and cable and so forth because I was making drop-down cameras years ago for hunting shipwrecks. And that company at the time was called Benthos, and they were in Katomet. They're right down the street from where I live now. And the side-scan sonar guys down there that I did work with, John Fish and Arnie Carr, live in Katomet as well. And they've found a lot of great shipwrecks.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, so it's a strange, it's a small community, and a lot of these people are located right around the New England area.
No, if with something like this, they said they had another expert on it, another deep-sea diver, aviation expert. They said the state of what's going on with the submersibles, because it's a pretty unregulated industry, is similar to what it was like aviation here in the early 20th century, when there were a lot of different companies trying different things, not a lot of regulations, if any, and supposedly after a couple of very bad crashes, they started to regulate and enforce things. Will this horrible incident with the Titan, do you think, change what's happening with submersibles?
I believe so. I think the Coast Guard is probably going to start doing regulations and safety checks. There's got to be some type of the Department of Transportation possibly could institute some type of guidelines. But like anything else, you know, you have people that now who are building rockets and going into space. And that seems to be somewhat, the regulation of that seems to be somewhat dubious. You know, private companies putting people onto rockets and sending them into space has never been done before. At the present moment, the United States, our federal government, does not have the ability to put a man into or recover him from space. We have to rely on the International Space Station, Russian rockets, and so forth. Other than that, really, it's the civilians. NASA can no longer do that. It's strange that we'd, from the 1960s, when I was sitting in, you know, 68, 69, watching these guys taking off in Apollo rockets. And now, 50, 60 years later, to see that we can't even put a man into space, but we have to have private individuals do it.
Very scary. And I just wanted to ask you a couple more questions to quantify this. So many people talk about going down to the Titanic. There seems to be almost an obsession with it. It's not the greatest loss of life. I know there were a lot of very high, they said it was unsinkable, a lot of very high-profile socialites, wealthy people on it. But you gave me a number off-air of how many estimated shipwrecks there are worldwide. Tell me that number again.
Yeah, UNESCO is an international treaty of preservation of historic and sites, and they're supposed to protect shipwrecks in international waters and so forth, particularly grave sites, but their estimates are in the 3 million range around the world. But that's probably when they're talking ships. Generally, ships are classified things of 200 feet, but that would include ancient vessels of much smaller size.
Okay. Now, what about loss of life? I know that a lot of people think, well, so many people lost their life on the Titanic. That doesn't even come close to the greatest loss of life in a shipwreck.
No, actually, it was funny because years ago I was compiling for a book that I haven't published yet a list of the world's worst disasters, and some of them were inland disasters. There were disasters in places like the Mississippi River. There was a, in the Civil War, there was a sidewheeler that burnt to the waterline, and significantly greater loss of life than 1,500. But in particularly in World War II, in Germany, during the evacuation of Eastern Europe in the approaching Russian forces, the Germans were evacuating places like Danzig, and they were putting them on ships. One of them was called the Wilhelm Gosloff, and it was torpedoed in a terrible winter storm in the Baltic, very rough seas. Was torpedoed with over 9,000. Some estimates I've seen people claim as many as 12,000 people on board that ship. But
my goodness.
It's pretty well documented that at least 9,000 people died on the Wilhelm Gosloff.
Do you have any other final comments or thoughts about what happened with this whole episode with the Titan submersible?
I think that what happened is that there was a structural failure. I think that the continued pressurization and relief of the pressure on that carbon fiber cylinder just simply started to break down the structural integrity, and it became weakened. And with those massive amounts of millions of tons, not pounds, but millions of tons of pressure, that it just simply had a failure, a structural failure. And when that happens, it happens instantaneously, completely. There is no leak. There is no drip of water. There's no making it back to the surface. It happens within a fraction of a second, and it's almost like an atomic bomb going off.
Do you think that this is going to stop or slow down people still trying to get to the lower depths of the ocean?
No. I know there are people that right now, the Russians do this with that MIR, or the MIR. They do this regularly, and they bring people out, and there are millionaires that are waiting and probably already have their trips booked. And I would have second thoughts about doing that. But
well, you are a fascinating interview, and you gave us a lot of good information about what's happening out there. Is definitely want to have you on again to talk more about this as they get more into the investigation about officially what happened. Paul, any other books that you recommend for people that might want to find out more about what's happening with shipwrecks, submersibles, etc.?
No particular books. I mean, there are a lot of them out there. I've got a couple of books on naval warfare. I've got a book on the Eagle 56 and so forth. The books that I've used in my research are basically more technical. They're very difficult reads, but there are a lot of great books. Primarily, the biggest publisher is the U.S. Naval Historical Center in Annapolis, but there are some great books on New England shipwrecks. John Fish wrote a great book, Lost Voyages. May be difficult to find right now, but okay. There are so many great books out there.
And still your book, The Sinking of the USS Eagle, PE-56.
Right.
That's still in print. And
yeah.
You've also been one on Smithsonian and GBH,
yeah.
And a number of other channels.
And I did a three-hour documentary, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, the one that came out on the Eagle 56, actually a National Geographic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go on YouTube, there are dozens of trailers on that particular three-hour documentary, and that covers the discovery after we searched for 18 years until we finally found that shipwreck. And it was right where we searched initially, showing you the difficulty of side-scan sonar searches, because we're right on that wreck, directly over it on the first day of our search. We didn't see it because it was behind a rock outcropping, so the ship itself was hidden by a shadow. And we ended up going back after we had covered like 23 square miles, and we found some other shipwrecks, and then we went back to the location of the first search, and we came at it from another angle, dropped the side scan deeper, and there we found the two pieces of the ship. Well, actually, they found the bow first, and then searched back a debris field and found the stern about 100 yards away, and then they found the boilers, which was the big contentious thing, and the boilers were sitting upright in the middle of the right between the two halves of the ship, sitting perfectly intact. All the water tubes and everything were completely intact, showing that the boilers did not explode. It was incredible, the state of preservation that they were
in. Some fascinating and some scary stories from the deep again. Paul Lawton, naval historian, lawyer, deep sea diver, researcher, you've brought a lot to the table here. We certainly appreciate this. We're going to get this whole interview up online. Again, Paul Lawton, thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.